Well, we would ask that you would take your Bibles this morning and turn with me again to the 19th chapter of the Gospel of John. John, and we're in chapter 19. I mentioned the Orrs this morning. We want to keep praying for them. They have shared a video with us that we wanted to share this morning, but they asked that we didn't put it on the internet. So I sent a note back saying, streaming live, is that okay? I haven't heard back, so hopefully I'll hear back this week, and all things are equal, we'll hear from them next Sunday. So just they have about a 3-5 minute clip in terms of the update on their ministry in Iraq. But this morning, John chapter 19. We are in the third part of a mini-series within a larger series on the Gospel of John. And I'm entitling this mini-series in John 18 and 19, 18 Hours One Friday, The Death of Jesus. Before we begin, or I would say as we begin, I would have you keep one thing in mind this morning as we continue our journey through these two chapters. That the one that we are talking of, Jesus Christ of Nazareth, is God. The one that is facing trial is God. The creator of the universe, including those he stands before. Okay, so let's just keep that in mind as we work our way through this text that does paint it in vivid colors. The term justice is thrown around a lot these days. I don't know if you've noticed. We live in a world that increasingly especially the last few years is on the pedestal of demanding justice. Everyone wants justice. It's a huge issue today. Before us in the news are the trials of the two Michaels in China. And the question of whether this is real justice or simply retaliation. Justice is the hallmark of the contemporary woke movement. And I'm not going to define that. We're not going down that rabbit trail this morning. Cries for racial, sexual, economic, and historic justice. In fact, we are told that injustice is systemic. A little aside, yes, it is in every culture and nation and race in this world. It's a subset of a term the Bible calls sin. But the cries for justice. And that kind of sets the backdrop for what we've been going through these last weeks, and we'll conclude next week. You want to talk about injustice. John 18 and 19 is injustice. Anything we talk about pales in comparison to this story. Here we have the ultimate injustice. That's why I said off the top, this is God, the perfect, holy God. It says in Isaiah 53, verse 9, as a prophecy concerning these events, they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death. Although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth, In fact, what it's saying here is that they killed an innocent man. Perfectly innocent. Well, where have we been? We began a few weeks ago in the first part of chapter 18 with the apprehension of Jesus in the garden. His apprehension in the garden. His arrest as Judas betrays him. No grounds for this arrest, but he's apprehended. Secondly, at the verses 12 to 27 of chapter 18, we talked about his examination by the chief priests as he was brought before first Annas and then Caiaphas, where they tried him, found him guilty, particularly of blasphemy, where he claimed to be God. John doesn't talk about that trial too much. You can go to the other gospel writers to read more about that. And then last week we began from verse 28 of chapter 18, which takes us down through the first half of verse 16 of chapter 19, the interrogation before Pilate. So we've gone from the garden to the chief priests, now to Pilate. Pilate being the governor of the area. And I said there are six sections to this scene of Jesus' interrogation before the Roman governor here. And we last time looked at the first three sections, the first three views into this scene. First of all, the accusation against Jesus, where we saw that Pilate said there is no grounds for his arrest. Then the conversation with Jesus that Pilate has, where Jesus tells him what kind of king he is. He's not an earthly king. He's a king from another realm. To which Pilate responds at the end, well, what is truth anyway? Although truth stands before him, it is the first of many ironies in this story. And then in the end, from the last part of verse 36 through verse 40 of chapter 18, we have the negotiation about Jesus, where Pilate tries to get out of this unjust situation by releasing a prisoner for the Jews who are before him. Well, this backfires as they shout for the insurrectionist Barabbas. Another irony here in that the guilty will go free and the innocent will be found guilty. Barabbas, I would remind you, and this is how we concluded last week, really represents all people. Jesus dies actually in the place of Barabbas. And I was listening to a message on this text this past week, and although we can't say for certain, we know that Jesus died in the middle cross that he, 24 hours before was perhaps intended for Barabbas. And if this hadn't happened, it would have probably been Barabbas who died on that cross. And he represents everyone as Jesus takes his place. And even the worst of murderers and insurrectionists, Jesus dies in the place of Barabbas. But Barabbas is freed. And Jesus is executed. Well, the story continues now in chapter 19, and we're at verse 1, reading down through verse the first half of verse 16. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, We have a law. And according to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God. When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave no answer. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" And Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." From then on, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. That was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. Well, the trial now continues. What is not in John's text is the going back and forth between Pilate and Herod. You can read about that in some of the other gospel accounts. John just keeps us before Pilate. So we've had the accusation against Jesus, the conversation with Jesus, the negotiation about Jesus. Now in chapter 19, verses 1 to 5, fourthly, I would have you see the humiliation of Jesus. The humiliation of Jesus. Pilate now seems to get more desperate. He knows Jesus is innocent. I would remind you, too, that the Romans had within their whole judicial system, they were really big on justice. They had a good judicial system, that you had a proper procedure for trials. The Jews were not there with respect to what they were doing with Jesus, but they couldn't overstep their bounds. But the Romans were concerned about justice and doing it right. They had a strong legal system. So Pilate is increasingly feeling trapped. So he devises another tactic. We don't know exactly what's behind this. We can surmise, perhaps to satisfy the desire of the crowd for their call for justice, that, okay, I'm going to punish him, I'll do something to him so that at least I'll say that I did something so that maybe this will appease them. Perhaps to elicit pity from some of the rest of the crowd when Jesus is flogged, they say, well, this is a little too much. We're not exactly sure, but we do know from verse 1 now that Pilate now has Jesus flogged. The word is too nice for what actually takes place here. He's whipped. I think that's a better term. If you read the gospel accounts and study a little bit of history, it appears that Jesus probably underwent two whippings, two floggings, two scourgings. The first to satisfy the crowd, which was the lesser, if you want to call it that. The second of which was a more severe flogging or whipping in the preparation of the person for execution on the cross. The first being a public demonstration, the second preparation for the crucifixion. You can do your own study. That seems to be probably what's going on here. The gospel writers all have little nuances on things. Now, I won't get into the details, but It is gruesome. I won't say too much about this. I've described both the whippings and the crucifixion in more vivid details in the past, and I've actually had people actually left the congregation. It can make you sick. But just to summarize, the floggings, particularly the second one, was inflicted by a whip of several thongs, each of which was loaded with pieces of bone and metal. One author says it could make pulp of a man's back. This was extremely painful. The early church historian, a man by the name of Eusebius, discusses martyrs at the time of Polycarp. Polycarp was a disciple of the gospel writer of John, late first century. And there were martyrs at that time, and he says, and I quote, this is the early church historian, that they were torn by scourges down to deep-seated veins and arteries, so that hidden contents of the recesses of their bodies, entrails, and organs were exposed to sight. It opened you up. And men often died simply by the whipping. Okay, so enough said. There's a lot in that term. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. Don't pass that by. And as I said off the top, he is innocent and he is God. I think perhaps also, as some suggest, Pilate is pointing out to the crowd that Jesus, in fact, is no king. Here's your king, all whipped. He's making a point. Verse 2 says that they put a crown of thorns on his head and a purple robe they draped around his shoulders. The robe probably from a Roman soldier. What are they doing? Ridiculing this king. They're joking around. I think ridiculing both Jesus and the Jews. Here's your king. The king of the Jews? In a certain way, Pilate trying to almost mock his accusers. What kind of a king is this? They're mocking him. Mocking continues in verse 3 through jesting, physical assault. Other gospel writers tell us that they knelt before him and spit on him. Luke 22:64 says that they said as they mocked him, "Prophesy, who hit you?" Ha ha! King. And they hurl their sarcastic abuse. And again, one of many ironies in the story. He is the king. He is the king of kings. He is the Lord of lords. That's why he says on a cross a little while later, "Father, forgive them. They don't have any idea what they're doing." And so today, even people who mock Jesus and ridicule him, they have no idea what they're doing. Using his name in vain. Have no idea whose name that is. This is the one who made them. Verse 4, Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." Repeatedly, as you go through this text, Pilate reiterates this over and over. He's not guilty. I don't find any guilt in him. He's not guilty. Lest there be any doubt that he did anything. Even the Roman authorities tell us he's not guilty. He's an innocent man. Verse 5, So Jesus came out, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate said to them, I think in some jest, behold the man, your king. Your claim, I think he says to them, is completely ridiculous. King? Verse 5, so Jesus came out. Okay, so, yes, behold the man. Jesus comes out. He says, and I just want to pause here just for a moment. Behold the man. Is that all that Jesus was? And if I know John, there's more to this than that. Yes, on one level, behold the man. But for those who know who he is, behold the man. What Pilate meant in terms of jest and ridicule, we understand is a statement of honor and glory. One author says, ah, yes, John, here indeed is the man, the Word made flesh. The man, all right. And I couldn't help but think of John 1:14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Behold the man. And what does John go on to say about the man who was made flesh? And we have seen his glory. Glory is of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. So what the Romans poked at and the Jews ridiculed and mocked disdain, we see glory. One author writes this. All the witnesses were too blind to see it at the time, but this man was displaying his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, in the very disgrace, pain, weakness, and brutalization that Pilate advanced as suitable evidence that he was a judicial irrelevance. But he wasn't a judicial irrelevance. What they saw was a bloody, beaten, whipped man, but what we see is glory. That is his glory. The Bible talks about the glory of the cross to which this would lead. For the world, it's utter humiliation, utter disdain, an utter joke. But for the believers, that is glory, because he is taking our place. I don't know if you ever thought on those terms. That kind of hit me. The humiliation of Jesus. We could have subtitled it, but really the glory or the glorification of Jesus. Fifthly, we have the agitation concerning Jesus. The agitation concerning Jesus. And by that I mean the agitation of Pilate as it just increases. Verses 6 to 11 of chapter 19, Pilate's attempt at scourging Jesus, that attempt fails miserably. Verse 6, when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they said, enough, 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 okay, okay. No. What'd they say? For the first time these words are uttered, crucify him, crucify him. He's already a bloody mess. See the evil in the hearts of these people. They hate him. Pilate again declares Jesus not guilty. Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. Now, he's not at this point handing Jesus over yet. What he's saying is, he's not guilty. If you won't accept my judgment, then crucify him yourself, if you can. And they can't. They don't have that authorization. Verse 7. The Jews changed tactics. There's a back and forth here. They now appeal to their own law. We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God. If you won't accept our first charge, then respect our law. And our law says that he's committed blasphemy. That he's the Son of God. Pilate hears this, and he's spooked. Verse 8, when Pilate heard the statement, he was even more afraid. More afraid. Already he senses that this is an unjust thing, so he's afraid for the fact that he's going to condemn an innocent man, which before Caesar is not acceptable. He's already afraid. But now he hears that they claim that Jesus calls himself the Son of God, and this raises his fear level. Now you say, how's that? Well, understand that virtually all of the population of the world and in which Pilate was a part of had a spiritual and supernatural understanding of life. They had a supernatural worldview. And in that worldview was a variety of gods who you wouldn't want to offend. Right? We know some of them. Zeus and Pluto, all the Greek gods, and they had a supernatural worldview. They were superstitious. And so when he hears that Jesus has claimed to be the Son of God, he's going, oh my goodness, what have I done? I've just flogged a potential God. What's going to happen to me? You see the superstition but this was a part of their worldview. You wouldn't want to offend those gods. There were stories within in that era of Greek gods who married women and had offspring. Maybe Jesus was one of these. And they had power. So he's freaking out. If Jesus is divine, and that's a possibility in his worldview, and Pilate had already scourged him, perhaps this would come back in judgment upon him. And crucifixion could have catastrophic consequences. You'd be executing a god. That's why he got even more afraid. Or remember in Matthew chapter 27, his wife has also come to him because she's had a dream and she says, I have nothing to do with this man. That's also a piece of this puzzle. The walls are closing in on Pilate and he just wants out. But he can't get out. He's trapped, and increasingly trapped, because he must make a decision. Verse 9. He entered his headquarters again and says to Jesus, where are you from? This is in response to the fact that Jesus had claimed to be the Son of God. Where are you from? Which planet? Which zone of the universe, which supernatural God are, that's the question here. Give me some more information, man. What are your origins? To which Jesus says nothing. And the question is, why does Jesus not respond? And most would suggest that he has already told Pilate earlier who he was and where he was from, about another kingdom. And he had simply been dismissed by the words of Pilate, "What is truth anyway?" He has nothing to add. Verse 10, this irritates Pilate. And he's increasingly grasping at straws. He says, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have the authority to release you and the authority to crucify you? Talk to me, man. Don't you know that I have authority?" Yeah, he has the authority. So far, he's trying to get around it. He flexes his political muscles. "Answer me." To which Jesus replies, "You would have no authority over me, none at all, unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." Now, what are we talking about that? What Jesus is not saying here, and if you do the careful studies, especially in the original language in terms of the Greek grammar and the tenses and stuff like that, and the gender of the pronouns, he's not saying God has given you the authority over me. God has. But Jesus is saying to him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it," and it is referring to the whole circumstances of him even coming here, "unless basically God has delivered me over here through the Jews' act already. That's why they are more responsible." What he's saying here is that you think you have so much power, but you have no power unless God has orchestrated this whole affair and you just happen to be at the right place at the right time. Don't give yourself too much credit. In fact, they're even more responsible and they have a greater guilt than you have. So don't get too high on the horse about all your authority and all your power. This whole situation is here because God has allowed it. I wouldn't even be here for you to judge had God not directed it. And you're not as significant or responsible as you think you are. The point, again, as we have alluded to many times, is that God is directing this whole affair. Yes, Pilate and to a greater degree the Jewish leadership are responsible, but they are simply fulfilling the plan of God. Two parallel tracks heading toward their conclusion. Peter says as much in Acts chapter 2 in his sermon at Pentecost, where he says, "This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God." God, the ultimate death of Jesus is because of the plan and foreknowledge of God, he says. "You crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men." So God orchestrated this whole thing, but you're responsible for doing it. And both these things are happening at the same time. They're responsible, but behind all of it is the plan and the foreknowledge and the orchestration of God. Sixth and finally, we have the determination regarding Jesus. The determination regarding Jesus in verses 12 to the first half of verse 16. Verse 12, again, Pilate tries to get out of it. "From then on, Pilate sought to release him." He keeps trying, but he's too weak. "But the Jews cried out." Another tactic. They persist. The trump card, we might say. If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. And Jesus says he's a king. He's an opponent of Caesar. And if you release him, you're not a friend of Caesar. This is treason. What will Caesar think if he hears you let a man who claims to be a king go? And he's answerable to Caesar. The great irony here, again, is that in order to execute Jesus, the Jews are proclaiming a greater loyalty to Caesar than that of Pilate. You see how nuts this gets? In addition, Jesus is himself far less a threat to Caesar than they are. They hate Caesar. Oh, we love Caesar. And behind all this is the ultimate lie. They hate Jesus more than they hate the king who's oppressing them. Now he's stuck. Really stuck. Jesus or Caesar? They got him. But isn't that really the question for everyone? Jesus or Caesar? It's a question of kingdoms, this world or that world, this kingdom or that one. And it takes courage in the face of the opposition to choose for Jesus. The Jews and Pilate chose Caesar. Verse 13. So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement. And for those of us who've been to Israel, when we were up to, we went up to there and we saw the place where this would have probably happened. And it's in Aramaic, it's called Gabbatha. Pilate now takes Jesus to the judgment seat. The Bema seat. Another irony. Where else does it talk about the Bema seat? Well, we read it later on, where Jesus will judge every man, woman, and child from that very seat himself. So what is happening here is the one who will ultimately judge the world is now being judged by this king. It's unbelievable. But Jesus is allowing this because he has a mission to perform. Verse 14. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover, I think simply meaning it's Passover is referring to the whole week. The day of preparation is the day of is Friday before the weekly Sabbath day. It's Friday. It was about the sixth hour. You can do your own study on this. I've come to the conclusion that what is probably being referred to here is the Roman calendar or a Roman time that is being used here. It's probably around 6 o'clock in the morning because Mark tells us that he's executed at 9. You can do your own study on that. And he says to the Jews, "Behold your king." Again, the note of irony. He was their king. He was their king. And again, it takes us back to the first chapter of John's Gospel, verse 11. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. Verse 15, and they cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him, kill our king." That's exactly what happened. "Not our king. Caesar is our king. We have no king but Caesar." After Pilate asks them if he should crucify their king. It's another irony. If it wasn't so sad, we'd laugh. Caesar's their king? This is ludicrous. Caesar's not their king. But they will do anything to get rid of their real king. And that's what makes them culpable. That's what makes anyone culpable. What do you do with the king? They who claimed to be God's people were really of the world. No matter how religious they sounded. So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. Matthew tells us that he washed his hands of the whole affair. Except you can't. No one can. We must all make a choice with respect to what to do with this king, this suffering king. Next week, they hang him on a cross. Terrible, but glorious. Who's the king? Who is the king of your life? Matthew chapter 16. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul?" The choice of Pilate and that of the Jews represents every man's decision. Next week, the crucifixion. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for what you did on our behalf. Yes, the evil deeds of man, but the great plan of God. May it not lose its relevance for us, that we would understand that the choice that Pilate had to make, the choice that the Jews had to make, is a choice that every man has to make. What do we do with Jesus? And just to make no choice is a choice. We can't wash our hands of this. Some are on the side of the Jews or are violently opposed. But some are kind of caught in the middle, but no choice is a choice. Lord, help us to make the right choice, the right decision. I pray for anyone this morning who might be watching, listening, who has never settled that in their own heart. might be paying lip service to this Jesus, but in fact, they're really the Jews, or they're really Pilate. But your word doesn't let us off the hook that easily. So I pray that we would make the decision we need to make, that we would follow Jesus and the way of the cross. We pray in his name.